Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to ensure North Texans have access to quality, comprehensive mental health care when they need it, regardless of their financial resources? MetroCare Services, the area's largest mental health service provider, works with clients from a variety of backgrounds, offering care to privately insured, publicly covered, and uninsured patients on a sliding fee scale. The organization serves 50,000 patients a year and has recently initiated a new program to educate professionals in the field and allow for clinical research. Dr. James Baker is CEO of MetroCare Services, which last month celebrated the opening of its new Center for Education and Research. Jim, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
So we've heard the statistic before that one in four adults in the United States in any given year could have a diagnosable mental illness. What do we know about the people who don't get treatment?
Well, still, the major reason people don't reach out for treatment has to do with the stigma that's involved with carrying those sorts of a diagnoses. So they resist getting treatment or feel they don't need treatment or just struggle along without having to reach out.
Mm-hmm. Are primary care doctors getting better at least providing sort of frontline screenings for people?
Yeah, the system is so short of psychiatrists, both in the private and public sector, that we're really dependent upon both family practice doctors and internal medicine specialists and even pediatricians to be the frontline and certainly getting a quick diagnosis and trying some of the less expensive and easier to use treatments.
Why is there such a shortage? Is this something that is just not made to seem very appealing when people are choosing a medical specialty?
Yeah. My experience way back in medical school was that the culture of medical school is somewhat different than the culture you ultimately end up in when you do mental health work or end up in psychiatry. So you really have to either want to do it when you first go to medical school mm-hmm. or something has to happen along the way that you decide that that's what you want to do.
So you have set up the Center for Education and Research. Talk a little bit about what that is, because it's not only doctors, it's also nurses and nurse practitioners and social workers. Talk about who will train at the center.
Well, we intend the center to be a place that allows anybody with any kind of clinical skills that are appropriate for working in public sector mental health to have a place to learn about how to apply those skills in the public sector. So we're talking about training psychiatrists, and we do have psychiatrists in training from UT Southwestern Medical School going through the center now. But there's a broad array of other clinicians that are desperately needed in the public sector, including things like speech therapists, occupational therapists, physical therapists. One of our neat programs at MetroCare is a program called Early Childhood Intervention mm-hmm. Program, which is a program for babies age 0 to up to age 3 who are identified with multiple developmental disabilities right at birth. And ECI provides in-home physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, support to the family to try to get those babies off to a good start. And we have a terrible time recruiting a physical therapist, an occupational therapist, speech therapist to come work in that kind of a program. And the feeling is, just like with the other mental health specialists, that they've just not had the experience of working in the public sector. They don't get that kind of training experience while they're in training. So the intent of the center is to provide a place where they can go and still meet the needs of their academic institutions that they come from for their training, but do it in a public sector and see what the work's like. We're pretty convinced that if we can get young people exposed to what public mental health has to offer, they'll get hooked and they'll stick around.
It's interesting to think that even for people who have chosen a health specialty, there's still something, it sounds like, of a stigma to this work.
Yeah, absolutely. There's still the stigma. And I certainly think that that's one of the issues that keeps people out of the field. And one of the advantages of having a place where they're basically exposed to their own stigmas is that you can help work through that and feel more comfortable with the population that we serve.
One thing, Jim, that I know that you've been adamant about is communicating the fact that with good treatment, many people, even with serious mental illnesses, can get better. They may not be cured, but they can certainly improve over time. Do you meet people in the community who think, well, I might consider that, but people feel like the work would be depressing or it would feel thankless and you've had a different experience?
Yes. One of the things that does occur is there, certainly in medical school training, I can speak to that, is the differentiation of the folks that are comfortable taking care of chronic illnesses like hypertension or diabetes that don't ever get better And those include schizophrenia in particular amongst severe mental illness. And the folks that would rather, you know, do something like surgery that you do something and cut something out and fix a problem ongoing.
And you're done.
Mm-hmm. So it does take a different group of folks a willingness to do that kind of work to take care of chronic mental illness. But again, the point is taking care of that population really isn't any different than taking care of folks with chronic blood pressure problems, chronic heart problems, as long as you have a degree of comfort in doing that. And again, the idea of a center is a place that folks can gain that comfort.
What kind of research will be conducted there?
Well, we're really excited about the opportunities for research. You know, there's a lot of research going on, particularly at the medical school here. There's some going on at SMU that's pertaining to the people that we take care of. And for whatever reasons, historically, there's not been good connections between the public mental health system and the medical school. And when we've been talking with the medical school about those possibilities for research, they've been really excited because we have, from their standpoint, a research potential pool of experimental folks to do experiments with of 50,000 people. So they're interested in that regard. We're interested in being able to bring state-of-the-art kinds of treatments to the patients that we serve. So if we can link one of our patients with a research project at UT Southwestern, it'll give the opportunity for that patient to get quality workup, evaluation, and some treatments that aren't standard in the public sector because they're just too expensive.
How does the relationship with UT Southwestern work?
Well, it started early on. The genesis for the center was there was a period of time at MetroCare where I was the only child psychiatrist in the whole center and is responsible for about 5,000 patients. Kids. And I really didn't think much about it until I started getting all these phone calls from the drug company representatives. Uh-huh. And it turned out that, of course, I'd become the largest prescriber of some of the major medications in the community and just decided that probably didn't want to be the last living child and adolescent psychiatrist in public sector in Dallas County. At about the same time, there was some residents in training over the medical school who expressed an interest in doing public sector. So we reached out, and they reached out to us about the same time. And we worked together first to establish some training programs within the center. And then collectively, we recruited a full-time UT Southwestern faculty person who works at MetroCare, whose job it is to provide, to help us make sure the environments meets the academic requirements for training and then supervises the residents in the training of other clinicians in the center. So it's evolved from there. It started out as let's make training available within the community mental health center and let's get somebody over there to supervise that, and then let's start doing some research that will benefit both the patients and the community as a whole.
What have we learned about the best ways to train young psychiatrists?
Well, I've been learning a lot about that. One of the things about working in public mental health is there's never enough doctor time to take care of all the patients mm-hmm. that are in need. And it turns out, I'm learning, that if you're going to provide a proper training environment, the young residents and medical students need a little bit more time with each patient. What happens historically when a resident or even a medical student walks into one of our clinics or an equivalent clinic across the state, all the clinicians that are their eyes get real big that there's somebody else to share the burden of all the patients.
Thank God you're here.
Yes. And so what we've really had to work with within the center is making sure that there's an environment that is also conducive, not to public service only, but also to training. Mm-hmm. So we make sure that our doctors who are providing the supervision have lower caseloads in order to provide some time and supervision for the residents and the medical students. And we also make sure that each resident and medical student has more time per patient. And one of the reasons for the need for the center was all that costs money. If one of our docs is supervising a resident instead of seeing patients, then there has to be some way to pay for that. And so we came up with the idea of the center as a way of getting some a program and looking for funding separate from traditional public sector funding in order to provide that kind of environment.
And has there been a lot of philanthropic interest in what you're trying to do?
I've been awed at the willingness of the Dallas community to lend a hand when you just go out and ask. Yeah. you know, you work in public sector and you think sometimes that you're out there doing it alone and you don't even think to go ask. We've had two huge contributors already to the center. One is the Meadows Foundation, which helped a lot with the infrastructure. And then Reese Jones Foundation has actually funded fellowships for us. And a fellowship is a program that occurs after you finish. You go to medical school, then you do your residency in psychiatry. We have a special program within the center, a fellowship, that gives you, allows you to do an extra year of training specifically in how to do public sector work, which includes having to work with, you have to be able to work with the folks down in Austin who fund services, the folks locally who fund it. Reese Jones has allowed us to offer fellowships, one-year fellowships, to provide that kind of training to people who have a special interest in doing public sector in the future.
We should step back here and define the term public sector. Are we talking mostly about lower-income patients who don't have private insurance?
Right. When I refer to public sector, it's folks who are really dependent upon you and me and other taxpayers to help fund their services.
Is there a greater stigma against people who don't have money to pay for their own public health, mental health care?
My experience is that when you have real severe mental illnesses that lead you to end up being in the public sector, losing your insurance, that you have a lot of social issues, economic issues mm-hmm. related to that mental illness, and there's certainly a lot of stigma that related to having those kinds of problems. You know, people with schizophrenia who can't get along with other people because of their disease, can't hold a job because of their disease, can't stay in stable housing. Certainly there's stigma related to that.
Do you work with families as well of the patients who are in your direct care through the social services that are provided?
Right. And the other thing to keep in mind is there's about we serve on in any given year about 5,000 children, mm-hmm. and you certainly can't deal with emotional disturbances and severe behavior problems in children without dealing with their families, for sure.
How often are you referred, or are patients referred to you by schools? I mean, does it take a while for children to be identified as having problems outside the ECI system?
Yeah, well, as a child psychiatrist in public sector, that's always been the number one place we get referrals from. A parent who's gotten a phone call from the school saying, do something about this kiddo or we're going to kick him out of school. Mm-hmm. It's a huge source of referrals for this center.
And is there such a thing as a typical period of therapy for the 50,000 patients you serve every year? Or do some come and see you, you know, a few times and some are going to be sort of ongoing with their care for a matter of years?
It really depends upon the nature of the diagnosis. You know, one of the nice things about major depression, for example, is it's very treatable. And most people who get good treatment for depression, the ideal treatment is a combination of one of the medications and then some supportive therapy or some sort of other counseling, get better in within a year or so. And yeah, they leave and never come back, hopefully. But people who have this tragic disease called schizophrenia, which usually occurs in early adulthood, somebody just going off into the workforce, just going off to school, and all of a sudden something happens within their brain and changes the way they see the world, changes the way they relate to their family and to others. That's a disorder that usually doesn't go away. And so we tend to take care of those folks for many, many years.
My guest this hour is Dr. James Baker. He is CEO of MetroCare Services, the largest provider of public mental health treatment in North Texas, which recently opened a new Center for Education and Research. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd love to hear from you now. You can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. James Baker. He is CEO of MetroCare Services, the largest provider of public mental health treatment in North Texas. The MetroCare Services recently has opened its Center for Education and Research, which will work in training mental health professionals for the future. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org. So are you going to ramp up the number of students that you have moving through the program, or did you sort of start the first year with the numbers that you'll maintain?
We hope it ramps up, but we've been really excited that since we started talking with the community and with the medical school in particular about the program, we've had a huge number of increase in the number of residents and a few medical students that are already rotating. Rotating's when you do training in the center, already doing some training with the center. We've got up to about 25 folks.
Wow.
Already. So,
what's the role with the shortage of psychiatrists? What's the role for professionals like nurse practitioners in the modern world?
Well, we've become really dependent upon nurse practitioners and in our center because of two factors. One's the lack of a psychiatrist interested in doing public sector, and the other is the reimbursement that we get paid from state programs and federal programs like Medicaid is so low that it's hard to cover the costs of physician care with those levels of reimbursement. So our medical staff in entirety is about 60 doctors, but that includes nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. So we couldn't do the work right now without them. And so it's been important to us that we reach out to the places that train nurse practitioners in particular. UT Arlington has a great training program for psychiatric nurse practitioners.
What does it take to oversee the work of a student psychiatrist or nurse practitioner or physician's assistant in the field of mental health? Because it's not, I would imagine, the same as sort of glancing at a chart, making sure that everything adds up in many cases. You have to really understand the history of the patient. Is that right?
Right. And so it takes considerable more time per patient to help make sure that you train medical students and residents correctly in psychiatry.
We have an email here from Dormand in Dallas who writes, I recently attended a program given by a manager who deals with the homeless in Dallas County. She reported that the root cause of our high numbers of homeless is Dallas County commissioners failing to pay for medicines for indigents other than generic medications. She further said many of the homeless feel that the indigent homeless feel that generic drugs make them feel out of sorts and that they choose not to take them. Is there a difference in the quality and the effectiveness of generic drugs? And is that an issue in terms of the effectiveness of what public health can do?
More and more research is showing less and less difference between the older generic medications, which cost a lot less, and the newer medications that tend to cost more. And one of the problems in public sector is there's not enough dollars to give everybody Cadillac care. So you have to make decisions all the time. Are you going to give a few people Cadillac care and then say no room into the end to a lot of people? Or are you going to give everybody Kia care and be able to say, come on in, you know, we're going to take care of everybody. We're going to do the best we can with the dollars we got and go from there. So it's been helpful in terms of making those difficult decisions to read the literature that suggests they're not that big a difference in the older and the newer medicines.
Does MetroCare have a relationship with the jail system in Dallas County, for instance, which my understanding is, by some estimates, one out of three of people incarcerated in this country enters prison with a diagnosable mental illness?
Yeah, I don't have the numbers offhand, but I think that sounds low, actually. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, you know, the two biggest areas we have to have an ongoing relationship with is the jail. One is the jail, and one is with the folks in the community like the Bridge here in Dallas that are interested in providing services to people who are homeless. A lot of people end up in jail who have a mental illness because of social behaviors that are inappropriate related to their mental illness, like schizophrenia. So they'll do something inappropriate in public and end up in jail on a misdemeanor. But it turns out if you do that three different times, you're a felon.
Yeah.
And so now you're stuck in that system. So it's important just in terms of managing the costs let alone the lives of those people, to try to do something to aggressively manage those mental illnesses in the jail. And so there's a large program in the jail. There's a large program in the state prison system. The reality is, in most communities like Dallas, the same is true in Houston, the largest public mental health hospital is the local jail.
I have to imagine that providing even Cadillac care to people who would otherwise be incarcerated for years on end still has to be a cheaper option.
You are probably correct about that, but even the Kia Care would go a long ways towards keeping a lot of folks who don't need to be in jail out of jail. And then the similar issue with the homeless population is probably 70% of people who are homeless have a mental illness or a substance abuse problem or both. And one of the things that goes a long ways towards reducing their costs in the community would be to get them some sort of care.
Does the factor of self-medicating that some people do to try to get some relief from whatever is sort of torturing them in the form of mental illness, the fact that that leads to drug abuse, does that contribute as well to the stigma against people who have mental illness?
Absolutely. The most of the difficulties with folks who have chronic mental illness are related to substance abuse. For example, issues like violence. Violence isn't a common theme in people with mental illness at all, but it's not uncommon in the combination of a mental illness and substance use. And that certainly leads to a lot of the stigma towards the population.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak with Carol in Irving. Hello, Carol.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Hi, my question is whether or not you're going to be offering any medical services to go along with the mental health services, because there are multiple medical issues that can aggravate mental illness. And, you know, I was just wondering if, like thyroid testing, for instance, thyroid can cause depression.
It's been an interesting problem in public mental health, particularly in Dallas, that it's actually easier to get mental health care than it is to get physical health care. And there is no doubt that the two go hand in hand. So we've been working at MetroCare. We have within one of our clinics now an internist who comes a couple of days a week, and we're trying to expand that to the other clinics. And another problem is that a lot of the medications that work best to treat mental illness turn out to have a lot of physical side effects to them. So if you can actually be helping somebody's mental health get better, but making their blood pressure and their heart disease much worse, so we have to go towards integrating those services better. One of the nice things about healthcare reform, if it goes through as it's currently passed in law, would be it really forces more integration of care like that, and that would be best for our patients.
Are you able to plan for training some care coordinators who would be sort of liaisons between the mental health side and the physiological health side?
Well, that's a great idea.
If only I had the money to go along with it, right?
Well, and there's some potentials for that down the line, but certainly that kind of case coordination of both physical and mental health care, and also coordination of making sure that there's adequate housing, mm-hmm. making sure that folks who are able to work and want to work and get jobs is a critical part of this kind of work.
We have an email here from Millie, who wants to know what kind of work you do with the autistic population and how many children with autism do you see? I guess a lot would be through the ECI system.
We're really excited about some of our new programs for autism in particular. The center takes care of about 50,000 people we serve. It's about 40,000 who have chronic mental illness or emotional problems. But we have 5,000 to 10,000 people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including autism, Asperger's disorder, forms of mental retardation. And one of the real problems is the funding for that particular group of folks was really cut back in the last Texas state legislative session. So we're having to make some changes in what we offer. But on our autism side in particular, we're offering a new program called Applied Behavioral Analysis, which has been shown research to be very effective in getting kids with autism off to a good start. We're wrapping up that program. We have a large program that deals with disruptive behaviors that occur in people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And we also provide home-based support services to folks with autism, Asperger's disorders, and other intellectual and developmental disabilities.
So when you talk about dealing with developmental disabilities, obviously there is a mental health component there and also an education component. Is there special training with regard to child development sort of separate from the mental health training?
Yeah, the folks that are best at taking care of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are folks that have a good understanding of all those sorts of developmental issues that impact their growth and can provide support to families and helping in that way. And unfortunately, there's a significant group of folks with developmental disabilities that have significant behavior problems, particularly at school, and you have to have specialists who do that kind of work as well. We have all of that.
We have an email here from Christiane who is curious about the type of organization MetroCare is, meaning is it a 503C? Was it created by Dallas County or by the state of Texas? And what the funding, where the funding comes from?
So it turns out it's all of the above. The Community Mental Health System, in which MetroCare is a part of, was created back during the 60s as part of the Johnson and Kennedy era. And the goal was to move people who had been institutionalized in places like State Hospital out at Terrell, which used to have a huge population, and at state schools, and they're called state living centers now, like the one up in Denton. And the idea was to move them back into the community and have them live closer to home.
These are for adults with severe
adults,
problems.
Right. That was how the Community Mental Health Center got started. And MetroCare got started as part of that movement in the 60s. And what it required back in those days was a match of dollars. The feds put up some dollars, and you had to have a third match, 33% from the state, and then the local community had to put up the match. And in putting up the match, typically the centers were started in Texas as a part of the county. So the MetroCare still has its relationship with Dallas County Commissioner's Court, where it's our board's appointed by the commissioners. But it's no longer one-third, one-third, one-third funding. In fact, most of the funding that we get is Medicaid dollars or a managed care program related to Medicaid that we earn, just like any other doctor's office would earn. So that's where most of our funding comes. It's not in grants at all. It's working like any other doctor's office where we provide a service and we bill an insurance company.
Mm-hmm. I want to point out here, we're getting some calls coming in and some emails with some very personal questions when people hear we have a psychiatrist on the air. We're not going to put you in the position of trying to answer those things because it would be irresponsible. But can you make a blanket recommendation for people who are out there right now who are hurting, who have not been able to find care, perhaps for financial reasons? Are you the folks they call? Do they call? Where do they go?
That would be fine. Mm-hmm. You know, if they want to give a call to our offices, the number is 214-743-1200. And whether you have insurance or not, or don't know whether you're eligible for public programs, our folks are experts in knowing what their proper place to send you is based on what your need is. And I would strongly encourage folks to be willing to take that step and just ask instead of living with the hurt and the pain.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Email address is think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phones to Stephanie in Fort Worth. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering what the role of psychologists would be in the programs that are in place and in the programs being contemplated.
Well, we're really excited about a relationship that we have with Southern Methodist University that's going to place a psychology student in our Center for Education and Research starting this September with a specific role of providing some specialized state-of-the-art psychotherapies, cognitive therapies for people with schizophrenia. So there is a huge role for psychology in the public sector, and we want to reach out and make sure that we're offering training opportunities for psychologists as well.
Is there a budget for things like, brain scans and things like that in the research that you're doing?
Not in our typical budget. One of the reasons we're interested in having like the relationship with UT Southwestern to do research is to give our patients access to that kind of workup or evaluation. One of our programs that we're doing with UT Southwestern is called a new onset psychosis clinic, and we're working really hard to identify patients who are coming to us. You know, usually, again, it's those early adulthood who have an onset of schizophrenia or other severe mental illness right at the beginning. And this is a research program through our center with UT Southwestern that allows folks with those disorders to get the big workup to make sure there isn't some sort of something in the brain going on, a tumor or something, or some other sort of medical problem that would mimic schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. And then that's the advantage of having the center and the advantage of the relationship with the school. They have the research dollars that allow to pay for that that we wouldn't be able to provide otherwise.
That's really interesting because you would think that there are probably a lot of people who end up sort of backing in little by little into intense relationship with psychiatric professionals, meaning that they've had some problems little by little over the years, as opposed to when you talk about a new onset patient, you can understand that this is a brand new set of behaviors and problems that need to be looked at.
Right. Most of the disorders have that kind of insidious startup that you're talking about, and you can have patients who present with depression and end up having schizophrenia. I had a patient when I was in training and was working in a child guidance center, 15-year-old, who presented to me because he was sad and depressed and was starting to avoid school. And was in those days, the primary treatment was psychotherapy. So I was seeing him regularly and followed him for over a couple years and watched as that depression turned into a pretty classic psychotic episode in schizophrenia. And that was painful to see, but it was also pretty clear what was going on. And he was fortunate to have the relationship going on when it happened.
Are we getting better at understanding which drugs will work best for which patients, or is it still sort of a trial and error process?
In my mind, it's still pretty trial and error, and the real revolution will come when the genetic testing is really optimized, so that there'll come a day when you can get a genetic test and it will tell you what medication is best to start with. But right now, it still tends to be trial and error.
And then you, I guess, have to wait and let the patient report on how they're feeling and then also observe them and then make adjustments as you go along.
And it's painful because these are severe disorders and they're painful disorders, and the medications can take weeks to really work. And if you end up spending weeks and it turns out to be a medication that didn't work that well, that's the problem for the patient in the long run.
My guest this hour is Dr. James Baker. He is CEO of MetroCare Services, which recently opened its new Center for Education and Research. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes and invite you to join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the CEO of MetroCare Services, Dr. James Baker. MetroCare has recently opened a new Center for Education and Research. We invite you to join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Jim, how do you ensure or try to stack the dice so that your students who train with you stay involved not only in mental health, but in public mental health after they've completed their training?
Yeah, well, part of the goal of having the center is to have an environment that's really conducive to persuading folks that this is the place they want to be. And we've been successful. We have three of our child psychiatrists right now working for us who actually were trainees in our program in the recent past, who after they finished their training did stay with us. So we're confident that we're starting to provide the kind of environment that does really help hook people in for the long term.
So I'm guessing that environment also includes watching out for burnout, which must be a huge risk for professionals in this area.
Well, burnout has certainly been a problem, certainly early in career. One of the nice things about working in public mental health, though, is that you tend to work, you're not in isolation. You work with a treatment team. You have counselors, you have case managers, you have lots of other kind of mutual support that really, in my experience over the years doing it, has helps alleviate those kinds of worries.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Martha in Dallas. Hello, Martha.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for your excellent show.
Oh, thank you.
Dr. Baker, I wanted to thank you because I'm a client of MentorCare. And I came in initially several years ago. I don't think the word crippled by depression is an exaggeration. I could barely put one foot in front of the other. And thanks to your professionals, I am now doing a great deal better and am able to live a much more fulfilling life. And I may end up, because one of the questions Chris asked earlier was how long people typically use your services. I may be using your services for the rest of my life because of my circumstances, but I would not be able to function. I would not be able to make my call if it were not for the people and the lovely professionals and lovely people that I have encountered. I use both your physician's assistant medication services and a counseling service. Without them, I would not be nearly as happy as I am today. And I just wanted to say thank you. MetroCare is a wonderful, wonderful program. And the only thing that I think is wrong with it is not enough people who need it know about it.
Thank you so much for your call, Martha.
You bet.
It's great to hear someone doing so well. That must be gratifying for you.
It's very helpful, and I hope she'll share that with the docs and the clinicians that take care of her, because that's one of the great things about doing this work is when your patients come in and tell you that you've been helpful to them.
Yeah. Are you able to track most people over time, or are there some that you think, I really cared about this patient, but I have no idea what happened?
Yeah. Most of our patients move, you know, between related to social issues, they'll move to other places in the country because of family. But there's a large enough amount of them that you get to follow for a long period of time to have those kinds of relationships and have the kind of, professional gratification that goes with long-term relationships with patients.
We have an email here from Deborah, who wants to know if similar services are available in suburban and rural counties.
Well, across the state of Texas, there's public mental health centers that cover the entire state. So what you can do is, if you know your zip code, you can go to the Department of State Health Services website and by county figure out which community mental health center is that serves your area and give them a call.
What's your feeling about ideas like telehealth for places where it's sort of practically very difficult for people to get to an appointment on a regular basis?
Well, I'm old enough to be really ambivalent about the idea of can you do a decent psychiatric evaluation using a television screen and a camera. But the reality is if the choice is between doing it that way or somebody not getting any help at all, it's kind of a no-brainer to me. So I'm interested, and we're seeing particularly in rural parts of Texas a huge increase in the amount of telemedicine done in mental health.
I have to imagine it's gotten easier now that a lot of people have computers with cameras and there's Skype and things like that. They don't have to go somewhere special to.
Well, you do have to go somewhere special still because of issues around confidentiality and some rules that the medical board has about the kind of oversight of those sorts of functions. But, you know, the day will come. And when you'll be able to get mental health services and a lot of other physical health services as well at home.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Fort Worth and speak with Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Chris. Listening to the show and heard you speak, just touch on genetics. And I read a book 10 years ago on the human genome that a journalist wrote. And there was a lot of optimism expressed at that time for breakthroughs in all areas of medicine, including mental health. And I'm just wondering why there hadn't been any more significant developments in that area than there have. And I'd like to take my answer offline.
Thanks for your call.
Well, it turns out that there's no doubt that mental health problems are primarily genetic and that they can be triggered by psychosocial things, but they're primarily genetic. But the genetics around them turns out to be very, very complicated. And so I think that's what's been the major roadblock in making significant progress in, for example, linking genes to what the proper medication is. But the time's coming.
Mm-hmm. So for now, what it is we don't understand necessarily the combination of genes that would cause one person to get sick and not another.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. We'll go back to the phones now. This time we have Nick on the line in Arlington. Hi, Nick.
How you doing?
Hi, great, thank you.
It's a great show. Jim, this is Nick Tedonio from the Big Texas Toy Run. I wanted you to stress the importance of volunteerism for organizations like yours and for people to step up and donate money and time to organizations like yours, as we've done for the past, I don't know how many years, because of the budget cuts and stuff. I mean, I run across your volunteers each and every year when we do our events, and I can't tell you enough of how dedicated these people are. I see the same ones year in, year out. And I'll just take comments off the air.
Thanks for your call.
So probably the most gratifying thing to me, heartwarming thing for me each year, is the Texas Toy Run that's run by Nick and his organization, a group of bikers who gather and bring to a central location around Christmas time toys for all the children that we serve in our programs and also the center in Tarrant County serves. And to watch these literally thousands of bikers showing up wanting to support our mission of service to the poor in our community and then children who would go without is extremely gratifying. And I know from interacting with them, it's gratifying to them as well. And so we certainly have plenty of volunteer opportunities within our center for folks, and we'd love to have folks who wanted to work in that way join our mission.
Do you have are there special sort of background checks required for volunteers who would be at the center that might be more stringent than other places they'd go?
Yes, and I don't know them, but our human resource department knows them by heart, and they are more strict, but we're vigilant about making sure they're done. But we certainly don't want that to get in the way of people choosing to help serve.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Kirsten in Dallas. Hi, Kirsten.
Hi. I was wondering how MetroCare deals with, on the one hand, polysubstance abuse in terms of whether or not or how they differentiate between a psychiatric problem where it already existed and the person self-medicated to try to deal with their psychiatric problem versus a psychiatric problem that may have been caused or exacerbated by the drug use. And I will take my answer off the air.
Thanks. Sounds like a hard thing to
In the real world of taking care of patients on a day-to-day basis, it's really difficult to distinguish that. So we tend to, in our center, err on the side of this is self-medicating and we're going to help treat the underlying disorder and help somebody get sober. And then if it turns out once they're sober that we were wrong, then that means somebody doesn't need the medication, just needs the support in the substance abuse community, and we make the proper referrals and on we go. But, I'd rather be aggressive in treating folks up front rather than risk missing something because we think it might be just substance related.
You mentioned that for a while you were the only child psychiatrist in your program and you had oversight for the care of 5,000 kids. Is there adequate care for people who have the money to pay for it out of their own pocket?
Well, in child psychiatry, even in Dallas, there's a shortage of folks to the point that if you have private insurance, many of the child psychiatrists in town are just doing a cash practice. So there's a whole group of working people who have a difficult time finding child psychiatrists. It's one of the reasons we've worked really hard to expand knowledge of our center and its services, because we are certainly willing to take care of people who want us to bill their insurance instead of paying cash up front. But child psychiatry in particular and psychiatry in general have always been shortage areas, and it doesn't matter whether you're poor or rich.
Do most people with private insurance tend to run out before their care ideally would be complete?
Well, it's been that way historically. One of the neat things that happened a couple of years ago is a law got passed in Washington that requires parity of benefits for mental health services that's comparable to physical health care services, so that you don't have 30-day limits or 30-visit limits on going to your cardiologist. You're not allowed to have 30-visit limits on going to your psychiatrist. So those limits ought to be going away, but the problem is that the law has been caught up in the regulatory process because, as my understanding, the insurance companies are worried about the impact on them financially of those kinds of changes. But when the regulations finally get passed, it ought to be a good thing for people with insurance. They ought to be able to get mental health services treated just like heart disease and diabetes and high blood pressure.
Talk about your future plans and vision for the Center for Education and Research, where you are now and where you hope to be maybe a decade from now.
Well, right now we've trying to convert one of our clinics into an academic environment so that we can provide a good learning opportunity for folks and have a strong relationship with UT Southwestern. And but we want to reach out to other medical schools around the our community and to the other academic institutions to make sure they're aware that we have a place here where they can expose their students to public mental health and really grow the number of people that are exposed to it in their training.
Are there programs in other parts of the country set up to do already what you're wanting to do?
There's nothing exactly like this. There's programs that do components that we're doing. There's public psychiatry training fellowships like the one that Reese Jones has started for us, helped us start elsewhere. But there's just not been a solid relationship between academic institutions and public mental health centers across the country, and it has to do with this tension between needing to have a supportive environment for training and the overwhelming service needs that is typical in a community mental health. So academic institutions have tended to shy away, and again, that's the notion of the center: is can we somehow have an academic training environment inside the center that exposes folks to public center without overwhelming them and gives them a taste and gets them hooked in.
That's an interesting point because, if you had a similar program without that support for the students, they might sort of be brought on to things that they weren't yet ready to handle independently.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And talk about, as you conduct all this research, how it's shared. Is this the kind of thing that goes into journals or that is just sort of passed on from one professional to the next?
No, it's intended. The research that we're discussing and some that's been going on has been published in the past and will be published through the faculty people at the University of Texas Southwestern and other academic institutions. They're interested in publishing it for sure.
If MetroCare had unlimited resources or reasonably unlimited resources, currently you serve 50,000 a year, what would that number be if you never had to think about budgets?
It's, really hard to say. The data suggests that a large percentage of the people who have these sorts of needs never reach out, and we certainly could do a much better job of making sure services were available, particularly to minority populations in our community. We way underserve, particularly the Hispanic community, because of stigma in that community. And I don't know the answer. It would be overwhelming for sure.
Dr. James Baker is CEO of MetroCare Services, which recently celebrated the opening of its new Center for Education and Research. Jim, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.